night is the first of that seven talks. And it's just on fear itself. Fear itself. So we're going to look at what fear is. We're going to move off into permutations of fear, where fear spreads out, as I had mentioned in some of the other talks. But tonight it's not so much about the object of fear, not the claustrophobia or the agoraphobia or the this phobia or that phobia, but rather about the nature of fear. Because if we don't have a good sense of the nature of fear, what fear is, not the object of fear again, then we're going to lose our way. We think that we can work on the objects of fear. We think if we just decondition ourselves to disliking enclosed places, that that will do something to the nature of fear itself. But it just, fear skips from one object to another. It's not as if we diminish the ratio of fear in us just by working on objects in which we are afraid of. We can be afraid of spiders or anything, but there is a deeper sense that fear springs forth in its self-preservating mode, regardless of what objects we decondition ourselves from. And so unless we have an idea and understanding of fear itself, then we're going to just, it's a little bit like squeezing one part of a tire and having it bulge out in another area. Now, I always like to start these things by looking at the cultural overlays of how the culture induces fear. Because unless we have a good sense of how we're inductees into fear, then we're going to continue to be conditioned in that way without realizing what the cause and effect of all that is and how it comes about. And how we say, let me just start off by saying that how we face our personal fear is intricately related to how we respond as a nation and as a species to external fear. How we face fear in ourselves. And if you look how, as a culture, we're facing fear now, you can see that we have a very, very poor and limited understanding of how to work with it intrapersonally. It's actually just disheartening because the way that our culture is based on terms of competition and the kind of insensitivity we have, and just as an example of that, I haven't watched either one of these programs, but I catch flashes of them sometimes, like as an advertisement when I watch the news or something. And one of them is this American Idol, where I was just watching this person who was auditioning, and whose heart was in, he wasn't very good. But then after it, the insensitive and cutting comments, just like knives, and you could feel, and then the camera does a close-up of the person's face as they're shocked from these descriptions, rather blunt and coarse comments concerning this person's music ability. I never, no consideration for the person. And somehow that's entertaining. Now I just ask you, what's entertaining about that? You see? To see somebody cut down, it's because of the base sense of inadequacy that we feel in ourselves. And to see somebody sliced down gives us a momentary rush of competency, of being above that fray, of superiority. And it's that kind of pervasive sense insensitivity that we have. The one is Survivor, which I have never seen either. But the back room sliding and the deceit and the manipulation for what? Money, if I understand the program. And we support it. So let's not say that it's being done to us. We support it with our eyes watching it. That's all the advertisement needs. If you didn't, your eyes weren't watching it, you would not support it, and that would not be on. So I really ask us to look how we hold ourselves in relationship to the insensitivity of our culture. Are we feeding it? Or are we not? Because we can see ourselves now as we rise up in terms of a threat. We can see how we embody fear and that insensitivity and that sense of competition. All of that has formed us, embodied us as people. And now we can see how it is that we are our actions through this sense of fear and what our actions do and how much listening and how much sensitivity are there to other nations in this, or how much is it just about us, and how about, you see, all of that has to do with how we're built, the psychological building blocks. I think we're in hell of a shape. I really do. I think this country, you know, I can't imagine anyone wanting to live in this country that's not living here. And we think we're such a prized place. All they have to do is turn on one of our television sets and I'd go back to India or wherever I might be. I mean that seriously. And if you look at our religions, the moral indignation in the center, you know, in the propagation of fear in the message of our religions. I had an interesting experience of that many years ago. I was hitchhiking across the country, pre-Dharma years. You can get a sense of how many years it must have been. And actually, I was hitchhiking from Seattle, where I was not living at the time, going back to where I was living at the time, which was Ohio. You know, so I was hitchhiking, I don't know where I was. And somebody picked me up, and it was a long ride, and he was a Jehovah Witness. And so he spent the time trying to indoctrinate me. And he had his Bible tucked under his seat, so he kept driving with one hand and pulling out the Bible and confirming what he was saying by reading a Bible verse that to me said nothing. You know, it was like one of these obscure textual readings, and he would say, see, the world's going to end, and he was even coming up with a date of when it was going to end. And by the end of that ride, I was like, oh my God. So anyway, so he lets me out in some I don't know where. And before I get out of the car, he takes out his clipboard and he says, now a few people are going to be saved from the apocalypse. He says, and all you have to do is sign this. I said, well, I thought in my mind, well, it's not going to hurt. So to this day, my name may be on the registrars. But there's a whole sense that of how we're controlled by our fears. We, you know, how they keep us tucked in. I mean, we can see that now. You know, all the administration has to do is to move its light from green to orange, you know, terrorist alert light, and Bush's popularity spikes, and because we come in line. Okay, don't question, just do. You see, if we just, if any fear, and we're in perfect alignment without question. And because we are a market economy, the need to want is indigenous to that, to this economy. But the problem is that when you foster a need, a wanting, you're fostering a fear of not having. So to every want, there is the corresponding fear of not being sufficient or not having enough. Every advertisement brings forth both of those messages into our heart. And when you have as many of those indoctrinations, terms of ads, throughout our lifetime, we are left with a sense of kind of pervasive anxiety that many, many people in this culture hold. Kind of a free-floating sense of not only inadequacy, of not being up to the moment, but the fear of what life may bring and that we're not going to be able to respond appropriately. That somehow we're going to be left out. And also, as a culture based in wanting, you have a very strong overlying philosophy of self-reliance, of individuality, of separateness. Individuality is sort of at the key of how we are in this culture. And that, of course, fosters this need to self-protect. You don't have individuality without fear, because fear, in fact, is the chemistry, the emotional chemistry that holds us in our individuality. So now just get a sense of what the culture does. We can't be lame in our understanding of that. We can't be passive in that. We have to know what's going on inside of ourselves and to see the implications of a commercial or an advertisement or something and what it does to us. And or a TV show. When people are getting hurt on the other end of that and we're not responding with heart, we're not responding with compassion, we're not responding as a normal human being, a natural, authentic human being would. So something unnatural is being bred into us. And that's fear. But I want to give you a different perception of fear. A very important perception of fear that I think is essential and can lead to a whole attitude shift. Fear is self-love. Get a feeling for what I mean by that. You see, fear's intentionality is to protect you. It has you in its heart. It's love turned askew. Now, when you're afraid, you can start appreciating the fact that fear arises instead of spiritually being shocked by it. I was on a retreat this last year in 2003 for a couple of months in Massachusetts, and I had a few days of just really kind of base level fear. And I thought, I was beyond that somehow. Which is, whenever I say something like that in my mind, then that state assuredly arises. And that, what I've learned is you just stay humble. And you don't assume anything, that you're over anything. But that state of fear, what I began to feel was that it was the messages of it, of the conditionality of the, was it was concerned about me. I was concerned about myself, you might say. And it was inappropriate because there really wasn't any reason to be. But the messages were trying to tuck me in, to get me safe, to, it had me in its heart. And when you begin to look objectively at fear, you begin to see that. And so, when you feel a fear, if you can see in that moment of it that you are in its heart, the heart of fear has you in it, and that it's really self-love, then you won't be so harsh in your reprimand for having that fear. You see? And it leads to a quieter, a more gentle understanding of, okay, it's not that we, you know, just allow it to do its torturous thing on us, but we don't hold it with such contempt. And it's really helped me immeasurably in working in that way. Now, as pervasive as fear is in this culture, how much do we really understand it? You see? I mean, it's everywhere. Indoctrinating us throughout the day. But how easy is it for all of us to say, each one of us to say, I am afraid? You see, we are loath to say that. Because what we have or feel behind the scenes is that fear represents a certain measurement of courage. If there is fear in me, that somehow I don't measure up on the courage scale. And this is something we really have to just eliminate, that way of thinking. The presence or absence of fear says nothing about the stability of our consciousness. Nothing. Some people have more because of the conditions from which they live, and other people have less. But the lack of courage, if there is a lack of courage, comes from not being willing to look into that fear. It doesn't come from the manifestation of fear. It comes from our fleeing, our aversion to it. So real courage is not the absence of fear, but the willingness to be able to look into fear itself. And that's the only measurement of a meditator's heart. Okay, let me look at this thing. Because fear will drive you endlessly until you orient yourself in the right way to it. I had a reoccurring dream that I had for years and years. In the dream, it was a psycho house. And I would go inside the psycho house into a winding spiral staircase to the top attic portion. And then there would be this feeling of terror in this chill that would go through my bones. And then I would, in terror, run out of the house, only to have that dream repeat itself for years, really. Not nightly, but periodically. And then I got involved in Dharma practice, and I went into my psycho house in a dream, and I got up to the top attic, and I had that feeling of being chilled in terror, and I started to run, and I just sat down on the floor, said, I'm not going. And the dream not only dissipated at that moment, but it's never come back. When we're willing to stay steadfast, and this is a word I will use again and again in the course of this series, because the Buddha would offer at least two, but these are the two that I remember, counterindications to fear. One was metta. The other was steadfastness. Of those two, I like steadfastness. Because what it essentially says is that I'm here. Now, you can do whatever you want, but I'm here. And I'm going to continue to walk and persist in exactly whatever it was that I was doing. Not recklessly, not heedlessly. It's not about that. But just, I'm just going to persist. You see, what's happened is that at one point, as a species, we were out on the Serengeti Plains and lions were chasing us. Well, we needed something to activate the adrenaline, and fear certainly does that. And so we would get up the tree and escape the lion. But now we've internalized that response, so it's become a subjective way we view the world with a sense of I. Now, if we keep fleeing from fear, we reinforce the sense of I, because I is reinforced in that turning away in a reversive posture to fear. But we've long since outgrown the Serengeti Plains. And outside of physical, you have to be clear that you're not in some kind of physical danger, the psychological danger that we promote moment after moment in many of our relationships and our sense of fear of being seen and all of the different ways that fear expresses ourself intrapsychically needs to be challenged. And the way we challenge that is to be steadfast. Just continue doing what you're doing. Yes, I'm afraid. And yes, what is he going to think of me and how is he going to look at me? And when I get up there, he's not going to... And you just go right up there anyway. Look him right in the eye. Say whatever you want to say. Fear is eating you alive, and you don't. And your activity is not altered. And when your activity is not altered, fear cannot withstand that steadfastness. It's dependent upon your flight for its reinforcement. Flee not, it will be, the duration of it will be short-lived. So steadfast, being steadfast in the face of fear is essential. It's also, do you want to be fear-based or heart-based? Because if you want to be fear-based, keep fleeing it, and you will be. Not only will you be in terms of fear as it arises, but most emotions, many emotions, have fear as their secondary, is the secondary emotion behind many emotions, like anger. We're afraid to be angry. Or loneliness, or depression. If we have a history of it, or we know somebody who've had a history of it, and it arises, then the secondary response to it is fear. But if you want to be heart-based, then that's something totally different. Then fear-based must be challenged. We have to challenge it. You don't have to do the big ones. You do the small ones. Look at the little occurrences throughout the day in which you're afraid to do something. And how the breadth of your opportunities are diminished and diminished more. As you breed fear, the channel that you can walk through narrows. What's the opportunities are, your choices are narrowed. Everything is narrowed down. It's widening, opening up, or narrowing down. So how do we meet fear when it arises in us? Are you like me? Well, I should be beyond this now. I shouldn't be having fear. Well, to argue with reality is insanity. So it's there, so just don't argue with it. Work with it. Or are you like the lion in The Wizard of Oz? Come on. Which is the overcompensation, because we feel so fearful inside that we become aggressive from our fear of fear. We overcompensate for it. Or disowning it, or denying it. You know, what's our strategy when fear arises? To know that strategy, to become aware of what it is that, how we lead when fear arises. And to bring forth the question, is this true? Is fear true? You see, we usually question what we don't like, what we have, what we're struggling with, but not the thing, not the emotional state. We usually question authority. Let's question authority. Well, what about fear? Is it true? It's saying something, that this is going to happen, that the inevitability of this is that, of this situation, is that it's going to go in a certain way. And then when I lead into the future and think about the way it's going to go, that's what fear is. It's an expectation of an event evolving into a certain way. And so when you ask, is this true in the moment, not what you think the future is going to bring, that's not true. How do you know that? How do you ever know that? You can cut fear right at its source. No, it's not true. It's not true. It's never true. Because when and if the worst case scenario actually does occur, that's not what we're afraid of. Because it's happening. It's like, I have lung cancer, let us say. I'm not afraid now of having lung cancer. I'm afraid of dying. But I'm not dead yet. And then I'm dying. So the worst thing does happen. I actually am dying. Well, now I'm not afraid of dying. I'm afraid of going to hell. You see, fear is the next thing. And if we ask from this thing, is the next thing true? Inevitably, it's not. It can't possibly be, because it hasn't occurred yet. Now, we don't do that intellectually. You don't say, is this true? I don't think it's going to be true. No, you do it through your heart. You do it through the moment. The moment's expression is the only truth we have in Dharma. The expression of the moment, what is actually occurring, is the only truth that you have anywhere, dharmic or otherwise. Dharma just points there. And so for us to say, is this true, brings us back into groundedness, steadfastness, into the Dharma frame of reference. It's not true. It's not true. And then, what is happening, what is true, is this feeling. What is not true is the thoughts that are generating the feeling, because they're telling me about some scenario. But so let me just be with this feeling. What is this feeling? Now, being with the feeling, I thought for a long period of time, if you just feel fear, that's a good mindfulness practice. It's not sufficient. You've got to question the thought. You've got to see the thought as being untrue. And yes, it'll provide a little bit of ground for you, but you'll still be shaking in your boots until you see conclusively that the expectation is false. It's always false. So let reality be what it is. That's it. It drives you to reality, you see, as any Dharma should. We just don't want to go there. We, in fact, many of us, perhaps most of us, want our fear. We want to be afraid. We don't want to give up our fear. We think it's like the warning system that really allows me safe passage. And it's not that there isn't wise consultation that fear can offer. I think there is. Like if you're afraid of water, you learn a kind of respect for water. You're not reckless. If you've had something happen to you in the past in water, then you bring that experience to bear in how you swim. But to live confined to what fear is telling us, to live entrapped within the messages of fear, isn't wise consultation at all. So can there be discernment here? Okay. I've had trouble swimming, I'm alone. It's not the right time to go. Okay. But that's not a fear response, you see. That's just listening to what fear says and bringing it into the consideration of more clarity, of clear comprehension. But to be driven by it. Sometimes I watch these television programs like these movies with Godzilla or one of these monsters that are stepping on people and going through the streets and everybody's screaming and... And I just turn around. That's it. Okay, it's you and me. Step on me. I would rather be stepped on than to encourage this mind state forever. So come on. Just get it over with. I mean, I feel that way. The panic, the what I call the duct tape mentality, if you get the message. It's not worth it. It's not worth it to me. I'll just take the consequences of not buying duct tape. So I just won't do it. I mean, it's just not worth it. You have to feel that it's not worth it. Because it's not true. It just isn't true. And therefore, you see, when we walk towards the untruth of fear, we walk into the heart of the Buddha's teaching. When we flee from fear, we go according to the manifestation of me. About me and self-protection. But when we turn towards it, then we're going into the heart of the teaching, into selflessness. And I'm not in any way, I'm actually, in the traditional sense of that word, pretty cowardice. I don't want to get stepped on by Godzilla. It's interesting, I was watching our cat. So we have this cat, and it sees another cat, and does it try to protect the territory? No, it... it smells a dog and won't go outside. Like it has no problem with the fear response. It's not questioning whether it's cowardice. It just ain't going to go there. I don't know. When you start understanding fear, you see, you're really moving into the alchemy of the spirit, where all things are safe. A wise man once said that the love of God and the fear of God are the same thing. Because in the alchemy of the spirit, where fear's message is seen as untrue, Then the love that was turned as an arrow towards oneself turns back around in its proper orientation to all things. And starts embracing rather than fleeing from. Even Godzilla. And that's the true alchemy of Buddhism. Any problem, any assertion, when seen as untrue, is pure gold. No longer cheap tin, but pure gold. And as we move through this series, we will look at ways that we have given ourselves over and to recover the gold in those strategies, within those strategies. That's what we're doing. That's what meditation, that's what Dharma practice is. Not to be fooled. Can we sit for a minute or two?